and welcome to the Super Secret Tech Podcast. This is episode number 4. We are a weekly podcast devoted to Magic the Gathering news, opinions, and insights with an eternal state of mind. I am your host, Brooks, joined by my co-hosts, Adam, Topher, and Peter. First off, I want to apologize a little bit for our week-long hiatus. We had a power outage get in our way, as well as a couple other personal issues, so we had to take a week off. But we are back this week and stronger than ever with a discussion of Mike Flores' classic article, Who's the Beatdown, and how it continues to be a gold standard in gameplay tactics. We'll also be defining what exactly different strategies mean. Lastly, we'll be asking you yet another trivia question. Any correct answers for the trivia question we receive will be entered into a drawing for a super special prize courtesy of Adam. But before we get into all that, let's talk about our weeks in Magic. Now, Topher, I can't help but notice when I logged onto Magic Online to play a league the other day, you had taken the top spot in the league leaderboard for Legacy.
Yeah, it's, I'd say it's been a long time coming, but that'd be a little too arrogant even for me. I guess I should be considering myself lucky that Glimpse of Randomness doesn't seem to have been playing recently. I think he's been at 10-5-0s for more than a week now, and I finally caught up to him. We'll see if he makes a comeback and deserves me, but...
I mean, you're going to keep winning these things, and...
who knows? Maybe I'll...
Knocking him down like...
Maybe I'll take a hiatus now. Who knows?
Well, you did just get a 5-0 in Modern, didn't you, just yesterday?
I was, like, pure luck. It was ridiculous. I bought and put together Black-Green Tron, do a league, go 1-4, do another one right after it, go 5-0, but, like, nothing had changed in between. It was just like, oh, look, natural Tron in my opener. I guess I win. So,
is it just like turn 3 Karns all day?
Basically, yeah. I mean, that generally wins me the game. Though I did, I had one game where this dude remanded Worldbreaker twice in a row. So I, each time I hit his lands. On the third one, he mana leaks it. And then, like, just keeps going. It's like, I don't know, he must have had all the lands in the world or something. Didn't faze him at all. And I had, like, no follow-up threat. Couldn't, like, draw anymore, and I still lost that one. So, I don't know. Big change of pace from 4 Brainstorms, 4 Ponders, and 4 Tops. Not used to drawing dead so often.
Fair enough. I know. I had an all-right week. No 5-0s. I top-4'd a standard PPTQ. Scooped in the semifinals to one of our buddies who ended up taking it down. Played some snakes, played some gifted Aetherborns, played some gear hulk to put counters on them. It was all right.
Let me ask, did you concede out of the kindness of your heart or your wallet?
Out of the kindness of my wallet. I got a good... the other person who made the finals, who finished way before we even started due to the... We had a very grindy black-green game. He finished 3 games in the time it took us to do the first one. I heard him say that he wasn't planning on splitting, so I got all of my opponent's prizes, and it was glorious.
I wish it were that easy to do here, but the judges here are very, very specific about that kind of stuff, and also I don't speak the same language, so double awkward.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a thin line. We're a pretty tight local community. I've played Magic in the same tournaments as him for, 2-3 years. It's understood at that point. I know the reason he's doing it is because he wants to win a PPTQ and go play in the RPTQ. I know the reason that I'm doing it is because I want Planeswalker points so I can have buys at the next Legacy GP. So
your situation, like, with the stores and how you handle talking to the people, reminds me of that scene from Always Sunny in Philadelphia where they go, and they can't refuse because of the implication.
Yes, that is very similar, except we are not on a boat.
Anyway, Peter, how was your week in Magic?
I got to play.
He also played in the PPTQ. Yeah. How was your standard experience, Peter?
I did very poorly, but this is my first standard competitive event I've ever played in. It was also my first time playing standard in 3 years. My experience as far as standard goes is I will watch it occasionally as background noise whenever the SCG is airing. And I had an abysmal 1-4.
He beat someone.
Yeah. I did beat somebody. Beating somebody is the first step to kind of not sucking.
Aside from the standard failings, I participated in our Legacy F&M and our Legacy Sunday event, playing both lands and Sneak and Show.
Very cool, except for the Sneak and Show part. But, you know, I'm not here to judge.
Eh.
Just inside. Just in my head, I'm here to judge.
Yeah. I don't think judging that. You real bad.
I'm judging you really hard right now, Peter.
It's fun to be the bad guy every now and again.
As a lands player, Sneak and Show is one of our absolute worst matchups, and sometimes it's fun stepping in the public enemy number one shoes and seeing how it feels to just step on people's dreams.
I don't think any of us has a particularly good Sneak and Show matchup.
I know I don't.
Anywho, this weekend I got to play in a Legacy event on Sunday, and I ended up winning our local Legacy event. Took home a foil Sylvan Library. Really good. Even better was all the decks I played were absolutely trash matchups for lands in the form of Red-Black Reanimator, Red-Black Reanimator again, Sneak and Show, and Mud Prison. So somehow I managed to...
I'm calling shenanigans, Brooks.
Shenanigans on what part of it?
All of that. That is a slog and a half, and you know it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I may or may not have metagamed the sideboard a little bit from what everyone was working on in the room. There may or may not have been an extra copy of Ancient Grudge and Surgical Extraction floating around there.
There we go.
Just gotta, you know, prepare for the audience.
Love it.
That's that. And by the way, that Ancient Grudge, you know, some people play Ancient Grudge and land sideboard. Some people don't. If your meta has a lot of the artifact shenanigans, boy, howdy, does that card do some work. I mean, I almost forgot. You know, it's been a long time since I played Modern, and I haven't played every green deck in Modern in a long time, and that card is a boss. This week, there was some recent Magic news. We got some pictures of the products for Modern Masters 3 and Amonkhet. And Modern Masters 3, you know, if they were going to pick exciting pack arts, they could have done better than Domri Rad or Stoic Angel, but who am I to judge? Once again, still judging very heavily internally, but, you know, not out loud.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to open Grizzlebrand, which is at an almost probably all-time low right now in terms of value.
Thanks, GP promos. I mean, I hope that at least the mythics in Modern Masters 3 are all at least worth $10 plus. I remember a game store back in the States that if you opened a... there was Comet Storm in Modern Masters, which was the only mythic that was just total garbo. And if you open a Comet Storm right there in front of the owner, they would give you another pack of Modern Masters for free. Just like, sorry. It wasn't that disappointing.
I remember once opening and getting past a Comet Storm in the same... I think it was Modern Masters 2, though. It was like the big red mythic blaze, whatever. It's a great draft deck. But we hopefully get to look forward to a bit more money cards in a set, since they've said it hasn't been made for draft, so I don't have the excuse of draft balance to justify.
I'm hoping for a nice, to be able to open a pack and get maybe, even if your rare isn't that good, two or three playable cards, like constructed playable cards in the commons and uncommons slots. That would do a lot for pack opening, because, like, you know, you open those packs, you know, maybe it's like a Horde of Notions, but you get a Remand and a whatever Mishra's Bauble or something like that in it. It's not that bad.
Are there any cards that you would like to see downgraded in rarity from rare to uncommon or uncommon to common in MM3 that are sorely in need of a reprint?
Yeah, I got two. Since you don't have to worry about draft balance, Kitchen Finks. Damn, make that thing a common. What is it now, like $13 now? It's outrageous. That and Path to Exile, but Path to Exile is a bit more...
Fits the mold.
Premier removal, I guess, is a bit more easy to stomach the price tag with that, but still, uncommons.
I would love to see Mishra's Bauble downgraded to common, because that card is just out of sight.
It doesn't do anything.
Mox Opal enabling, different card type enabling, zero mana abomination.
I'm hoping, though, even though it wasn't designed to be a fun draft set, that it is a fun draft set, because I like fun draft sets.
So what do you guys think about this sweet new Amonkhet art and packaging out?
Crazy cat lady, new full art lands, what's not to like?
I'm going to quote Adam here. I'm so excited to not change out the basic lands in my Legacy deck.
Yeah. I've got my John Avon lands. They look great. They're shiny. They're expensive. The new ones do look cool. I'll probably try to pick up some basics to use as like to as full arts to draft with or whatever. Mm-hmm. Although cats, it is cool that you said there was a cat lady on it because I'm hoping there is another strong, aggressive cat for modern cat tribals. I just feel like it's one or two good cats away from being competitive.
What so, about, like, how excited would you be if Gaddy Teague was a cat?
I would.
It could be called Catic Teague.
Oh!
Shit, yeah, though, I'd be rock hard.
Catic Teague. Someone needs to get an alter to make that. That's got to be delightful. So, yeah, lands look cool. So.
That's about it.
Yeah.
I did hear -1/-1 counters might be making a comeback.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Due to a translation of Liliana's first ability. If you have someone who's like new to Magic and they pick up 6 booster packs and make a shitty little deck to play against their other, you know, their friends or whatever.
Their other shitty little friends. Yeah. Way to then just talk down on people.
Yeah. Sorry, if you're new to Magic and don't know all the rules, then it just seems really confusing to have all these counters. And maybe you don't know they...
Back when they talked about canceling the counters out and making that rule change, Mark Rosewater also talked about in one of his articles how they intentionally did not put +1/+1 and -1/-1 counters in the same block together because they wanted the limited environment to be more clean, but standard is fair game. I'm surprised it's gone as long as it has, though, without -1/-1 counters, and I am frankly excited to see a little bit of variation.
We'll be right back with our main segment after these inspiring words from the one and only Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I'll tell you what I think.
It doesn't matter what you think. Now what you do...
Peter Archambault.
And I quote, you know your damn role, and shut your damn mouth.
Welcome to our main segment, where we are going to revisit the classic Mike Flores article, Who's the Beatdown?, and how it's just as relevant to Legacy Magic as ever. As the format continues to evolve, many decks have picked up tools that allow them to transition their roles as a response to each opponent's strategy. This has a tendency to muddy the waters a bit and make it confusing about the taxonomy of strategy, and makes knowing your role potentially confusing. Today, we're going to break down some of the format's more popular decks and help you remain cognizant of who is really the beatdown. So in every game of Magic, there's always a beatdown deck, according to the article here, and there's always a control deck. Even in the 75-card mirror match, one player is the beatdown and one is the control. I think that Burn is a really good example of aggro versus control or beatdown versus control in describing the 75-card mirror. Like, if you're playing the Burn deck against another Burn deck, same lists, and they're on the play and they lead on a Goblin Guide, let's say, on your turn, do you play the Goblin Guide from your hand or do you bolt their Goblin Guide? I tend to fall in the camp of I'm the control deck at this point. They have the tempo advantage and I'm up a card. And I think the right thing to do is kill their repeatable source of damage. Who's the beatdown in that scenario?
Yeah. You're up a card on the draw, that definitely makes sense that you go into a more reactive role. You know, they have the Goblin Guide out there, and if the board state maintains parity for the rest of the game, they're going to beat you. If they have a better chance of their Goblin Guide snowballing into, oh, well, I'm following that with 2 Swift Spears and a, you know, and some more burn spells, that gives them the advantage. Now, if your hand very well could be 2 Goblin Guides and 2 Eidolons, in which case you're not going to be able to play the control role in the matchup, but typically being up one card puts you in the control role.
More so than even being on the play or the draw, you got to judge in the context of your hand. You know, are you playing a hand that can erase the Tremont Goblin Guide? You know, the example you used was if your hand's full of creatures, then you don't really have a game plan for being the control deck. You've got to try to out-aggro them, which can certainly be difficult being on the draw, but you got to make do with the cards in your hand. But yes, generally the deck with more cards, more card advantage is the control deck. Obviously the one that's faster, maybe the one that got the tempo on the turn one play is the aggro deck. The 75 card mirrors are almost always going to be an issue of just what parts of your decks you drew. You know, in the Delver mirror, if you kept the removal cantrip hand, you know you're going to be the control deck. And if your opponent kept a three Delver hand, they know they're going to be the aggro. It's less of a situation of, I feel, who's on the player draw, but just what cards you drew.
And to add on to that, just because you're playing a deck like Burn or Miracles doesn't mean you're always the aggro deck or always the control deck. Knowing your role is very different from knowing your deck's general strategy. And we're going to go over the different types of strategies of decks in Legacy first. Now, in Magic, there are generally thought to be four different categories of strategy that most decks will fall into. These are aggro, which we're going to include tempo decks in our description of aggro, mid-range, combo, and control, by which we're going to include prison decks. Now, we are defining strategic archetypes by their relative power level as the game progresses. Each of these is not mutually exclusive, and there are often hybrid strategies of these four concepts, as we will discuss in our deck analysis later on. For example, an aggro deck like Blue-Red Delver starts off the game at a 10 out of 10 in power on turns 1 and 2, and begins to taper off in relative power level as the game progresses. Respectively, mid-range has the most powerful turns on 2 through 5, and control has the greatest power on turns 5 and beyond. The only odd man out here is combo, which generally has a power level of around a 3 out of 10 for the majority of the game, but on their critical turn, the power level goes to 10, and you're probably dead.
So when I think of aggressive decks in Legacy, I think of the classic Burn, Mono Red Burn, as well as Blue-Red Delver, and Eldrazi is a good example of an aggressive deck. These decks all have very linear game plans about playing threats, attacking with them, reducing your life total to zero before you can react. Some of the decks, Burn, just have the one game plan of, I'm going to burn you for 20 damage, attack some goblin guys, lava spike you. Blue-Red Delver and Eldrazi, they're a little slower. They support their aggressiveness with either the lock pieces or some light counter magic, but their game plan is always going to be the same. Get you down to zero before you can do anything about it.
So a mix of light disruption and threats on turns 1 and 2, and hope that those carry you the rest of the way.
Yeah, these are the kind of decks that, with the exception of the occasional Reality Smasher off the top, these decks don't have a lot of, their threats don't curve very well. When you play a turn 4 or 5 Monastery Swift Spear or Unflip Delver, that's not very good. You want to be playing these cards early and swinging often.
What's also important to note is that these decks don't have a backup game plan. You know, we said Blue-Red Delver, but we didn't include Rug or Grixis or Bug Delver, because while those decks might prefer to play as aggro, they have a game plan if they need to play defensive and be the control deck. But Blue-Red Delver, Eldrazi, and Burn, they don't have any secondary game plan. They don't have any threats that translate well in the late game, or in the case of Eldrazi, they don't have a path forward that allows them to play something that isn't aggro. There isn't any, you know, plan B for them. And that's how I think we really define what's an aggro deck versus what's an aggro control deck or aggro mid-range deck or something is. Can they adapt their game plan effectively to something other than aggro? And in these two decks' cases, I think the answer to that is no.
So in the mid-range category, the most common deck that you'll see these days is Troom Name Bug, which seeks to deploy a 3-drop that's undercosted and overpowered on turns 2 through 4 and protect it on its way to victory, decaying and pushing whatever gets in its way. Other examples of mid-range decks would be stuff like Dragon Stompy, which seeks to overload the board with bombastic threats, turns 2 through 4, thanks to the assistance of Soul Lands. And then there's a deck like Maverick, which is a more traditional mid-range deck in that it has a curve of 1, 2, 3, or it uses Aether Vial to help dodge counter magic and deploy more threats to the board. But the overarching goal is still the same. Dominate the mid game, have bigger creatures than aggressive decks, and win with said big creatures. The other deck I want to touch on that is traditionally considered mid-range, but not very popular at the moment, are Deathblade decks. These four-color decks are under harassment right now because their mana base is so fragile, and Stoneforge Mystic just isn't as good as it used to be with all these Leovolds and Trinity Nemesis running around. But the main idea is still the same. Deploy under-costed, powerful mid-game threats. Hope to grind out the aggro decks by playing superior cards. Hope to not get Wasteland. Mid-range decks are traditionally strong against aggressive decks because as the aggressive deck starts to taper off, that's when mid-range really hits its stride and plays its most powerful cards, which are usually great ways to stonewall aggressive threats.
So the reason why Truename Bug is a mid-range deck and not an aggro deck, because you make the argument that a turn three Truename is a pretty aggressive play, comes down to what sort of threats they're playing. Whereas, you know, Burn, Blue-Red Delver are playing one and two drops. Their game plan is to get on the board first and to be swinging first. While certainly a mid-range deck would love to play a turn two Truename whenever they could, the thing to take away from that is that they're playing a three drop. Mid-range decks are okay with being slower. Their game plan is to essentially trump your threats with theirs. They're not looking for inevitability. They're just looking to be bigger than you. That's why turn three, swinging Truename for four power, is the mid-range play and not the aggro play.
I think it's also interesting to talk about how Legacy's definition of mid-range is different than other formats' definitions of mid-range, just because Fast mana accelerants.
That's very true. In other formats, mid-range is synonymous with ramp because you can competitively run ramp in other formats. That doesn't mean to say that the legacy mid-range strategies that don't run ramp aren't mid-range. What it all means is that mid-range is trying to hit the mid-game and take advantage of its threats that are played during mid-game, whereas aggro is ideally playing one and two drops that it can get out very early and kill as quickly as possible. Mid-range just wants to play a bit more defensive and then leverage its advantage of just having bigger threats. That's why mid-range typically has a good aggro matchup. So moving on from mid-range, you've got control. I'm sure everyone knows control is the archetype that is trying to have inevitability. Compared to every other archetype, it in theory has the best late game. And its entire game plan just hinges on not losing until it can win. Generally, it's just removal, counter magic, and threats that can be leveraged in the late game. Control, by its definition, I suppose, isn't going to be prepped to play any aggressive roles. In any matchup, it is going to not be the beatdown. And historically, its worst matchups are the decks where it does have to be the beatdown. Miracles versus Cloud Posts is as an example. What is noteworthy is that Monastery Mentor has allowed Miracles to play the beat down much more effectively when it has to. And as a result, Cloud Post has become a very winnable matchup. But most control decks don't have that option. That's why also typically Planeswalkers are a very great option against control decks, because they don't have the ability to pressure a Planeswalker. They can't play the beat down when they have to be.
Planeswalkers are good against the Miracles.
So what you're saying is Planeswalkers are traditionally really good threats against control and really good ways to attack their strategy, because there are less inherent answers to Planeswalkers in the form of just cards, and the answers to Planeswalkers are most commonly creatures, which most control decks are traditionally light on or not running at all. Those creatures don't even usually get deployed until turn three or later in most cases, which make it even hard to answer an earlier Planeswalker as early as turn three or four. Now, this extends outside of Miracles to other control decks, like Prison decks, like Mudstacks, and Prison decks like Enchantress, because they don't usually generate creatures, nor a way to deal with Planeswalkers. Now, Enchantress has the one or two Miser's copies of Banishing Light, and Mudstacks occasionally has Pithing Needle. But outside of those sort of responses to Planeswalkers, these decks have a hard time answering them, especially if the ultimate is as game-breaking as that of Liliana of the Veil, or just outright game-winning, like Jace the Mindsculpt.
That's very true. Control relies on inevitability.
The last of our four strategies that we're going to talk about is combo. I'm sure we all have a particular combo deck we love to play or hate to play against, but common examples of combo decks would be variants of Storm, such as Belcher, Tess, or Ant, Reanimator, Blue-Black or Red-Black, respectively, Sneak and Show or Omni Show, more the latter than the former, I would say, it's a true combo deck, and Turbo Depths, which seeks to make 2020s as fast as possible and as often as possible. All these decks seem to revolve in that same place we were talking about before, where their turns are consistently mediocre until that one big turn. Storm is trying to cast 10 plus spells in one turn with protection to kill your opponent with Tendrils of Agony. Reanimator is slowly just cantripping, setting up their hand so they can dump a fatty in the yard and pull it out over the course of your end step in their main phase or just one turn, a la Dark Ritual. Sneak and Show Omni Show, everybody's least favorite two-card combo because it feels so great to have an Emrakul dropped into play against you on turn one or two. And lastly, Turbo Depths, which just slowly plays lands and sets up their redundancies or pieces to make Merit Lodge and protect it. Whether that's setting up Pithing Needle to prevent against Caracas, whether it's getting a Knot of this World in their hand to shield against Swords to Plowshares, or if it's as simple as threatening the combo twice in one turn, Turbo Depths will set up that big turn where they go to kill the opponent.
Now, there is in Legacy specifically, a lot of the combo decks, especially the ones we just named, are very similar to what we were discussing about the aggro decks. The combo decks, whether it be, you know, Storm, Reanimator, Turbo Depths, they all have a singular game plan, and they want to accomplish that ideally as quickly or as safely as possible. If you can have a couple well-timed surgicals, there's not going to be a fallback plan for Reanimator. They have just the one game plan, and they don't really deviate from it.
Well, that's an actually really interesting part about aggro and combo, as we were talking about when their cards are at their best. And aggro, we say that they're best on turns one and two, which is correct. But aggro is spending some of its cards earlier in the form of commitments to the board, a la Delver of Secrets, Young Pyromancer, Deathrite Shaman, that type of stuff. Whereas combo is saving their cards for one turn. So aggro will spread out the cards over the first couple turns of the game, whereas combo will replace their cards until they get the exact combination, hence combo, of cards that they're looking for. Much like ice cream, these are not the only flavors, just the most common. Think vanilla, chocolate, strawberry. However, these flavors of strategy can be blended much like a delightful Neapolitan, as some decks commonly occupy two or more strategies. What are some examples that you like to play? I know that Adam and Peter both play decks that are examples of two or more strategies overlapping and working usually harmoniously together. Peter, do you want to tell us a little bit about Lanz's strategy on the whole?
Sure. So when we start looking at hybrid archetypes, we can look at Lanz as a combo control style deck. It's kind of a unique archetype in that sometimes your game plan is just to grind your opponent out of resources and win at your leisure, or other times you can get a turn to win. In Lanz's case, we get both aspects of being able to use Life from the Loam and Punishing Fire as a means to grind and control our opponent, or we could get a hand with Exploration and, boop, win on turn two of the 2020. The deck can shift gears from turn to turn depending on what we dredge or what the board state is and if we want to take actual draw steps versus dredging. And the deck is flexible enough that its role typically wants to be control until it wants to turn the corner and just finish off the opponent.
It's kind of like the chocolate and the peanut butter coming together. You got chocolate in my peanut butter. You got peanut butter in my chocolate. You know, the strategy of Dark Depths and Thespian Stage, with both of them being lands and comboing together to make a 2020, which threatens to win the game on the spot, as well as the combination of Loam and Punishing Fire and Grove and Wasteland, and all these cards working harmoniously together, really gives lands some flexibility and power as a combo and control deck. You can look at the deck you're playing against and see how your hand lines up or the way they're playing lines up against what you're doing and pick the combo or control side or whatever your hand dictates as far as how you're going to play the game. How about you, Adam? I know elves we have categorized as an aggro combo deck. Do you mind telling us what exactly an aggro combo deck is?
All right. Well, so elves is, like you said, an aggro combo deck. This typically means that it's going to be the most aggressive deck in any given matchup. However, what your opponents do can really dictate how aggressive you are. Because elves is a green-based deck, it's hard to act in the control role in most matchups. However, it is usually a turn or two slower than the format's other combo decks. This is a trade-off for having the stronger aggro secondary game plan of swarming the board with, you know, 4-5 1/1s and pushing through smaller chunks of damage. Because it doesn't have, you know, the blue in it for force of will and typically runs the reactive discard and whatnot out of the sideboard, it is a lot less likely to be reactive of its opponent's plays. You know, Deathrite Shaman gives the deck some disruption for the format's graveyard-based strategies. Symbiote lets us protect ourselves from spot removal. And we run one of such as Scavenging Ooze, Leovold, Reclamation Sage, and whatnot to not be completely dead to some cards and strategies. But typically, Elves is going to be the aggressive role. Needs to build its board up with 1/1s in order to reach a critical mass. And while it's doing this, it is just a plain, you know, aggressive creature deck. There are a surprising number of matches that Elves will win by dumping 6 power on the board and swinging for 3 turns while holding a Deathrite Shaman up. However, there are some matches that your goal is to draw 16 cards on turn 2 with a Glimpse of Nature and come swinging in with a Craterhoof Behemoth. Whether it's aggro or combo depends, you know, on what your opponent is bringing to the table, if they're bringing dazes, discard spells, and whatnot. You have to adapt your style to sort of counteract what they're trying to do.
That seems to be a really common thread between all of these hybrid strategies, is that a lot of times your hand, your opening hand, will dictate exactly how your strategy is going to play out for that game. But sometimes you have a choice in the matter, and you have to choose the path that you feel will get you closer to victory.
I know with elves, especially in the post-board games, we will slow ourselves down by including cards like, you know, Thought Seize, Cabal Therapy, Surgical Extraction, Gaddock Teague.
Abrupt Decay.
Yeah, that sort of thing, which make that one turn where you combo off that most traditional combo decks have. You know, if you're playing Storm, it's the turn you cast 10 spells. It's the game-winning turn. Because there are so many cards that don't fit that game plan in post-board, the deck is slow enough. It becomes a less reliable combo deck. Against decks like Dredge and Reanimator, you really need to find yourself switching roles. Your goal in the matchup is not to put 5 power on the board turn 2. It's untap with the Deathrite Shaman and react to what they're trying to do. Because their cards are so much more powerful that the second they reanimate Niona and Name Green, the game's over. So you need to be mindful of that.
One example I wanted to bring up was Bug Delver. Most Delver decks, I feel like, would fit nicely into aggro control or aggro, like a tempo style deck, just straight aggressive. But Bug Delver is unique in that it is an aggro midrange deck. And that's the only example of this that I can really think of, is that in game one, it plays a little bit lower to the ground. Still has a couple 3-drops of threats, but not as many as, say, a Bug Delver, or I'm sorry, not as many as, say, a True Name Bug or a Deathblade or a Maverick-style deck. But what its goal is just like Delver, to disrupt you in early turns, play difficult to deal with spells, play things at 2-for-1 you, a la Hymn to Torok, and just get you dead as fast as possible. It has a little bit of an extra hurdle because it doesn't have burn in the main deck, but what makes it a mid-range deck is that it embraces the fact that it's a little, just a touch slower than your traditional Delver decks after sideboarding. So a lot of times you'll see stuff like adding Jace the Mind Sculptor, Vendilion Click, Sylvan Library, sometimes even Trunian Nemesis, to help deal with and get past other mid-rangeier strategies. This deck really makes a transition more than the hybrid decks like we're talking about. So, you know, Elves has to choose, am I picking the aggro game plan or the combo game plan, or is it going to just see what develops, reactionary style to my opponent's cards? Land says, am I going to play Prison or am I going to play combo? The cool thing about Bug Delver is that it plays aggro game one most of the time, and then it transitions into a mid-range deck going into games 2 and 3, slows down, plays more powerful threats to line up better against the opponent's answers that are addressing your threats. Topher, I remember you talking about Death and Taxes and how you feel that it's an aggro control deck and that it controls the board but can also beat down with creatures. What do you feel that is? Do you feel that's more of like a hybrid, you're picking one half of the strategy, or you are just kind of progressing as the game goes along and getting greater inevitability?
Well, what's important to kind of note about the hybrid rules is they're not going to normally be as strong as the dedicated decks are. So Death and Taxes is not as good an aggro deck as Burn, and it's obviously not as good to control deck as Miracles, but it has elements of both. It has what is important to take away is that the Death and Taxes pilot can choose to pursue either strategy. It can choose to curve Mother of Runes into a Stoneforge Mystic and Voltron up and get going. Or it can choose to sit back on Thalia and Caracas and Aethervial and Wastelands and Ports and play the control game plan. And the deck has its options available to the pilot. The pilot can take the deck and say, all right, we're playing against Storm. I got to beat the control deck. I can't waste my time playing a Stoneforge Mystic. I got to keep my mana denial up. I got to get this Thalia out. Whereas if they're going against, say, a Shardless Bug, you know, they're not going to outmuscle Shardless Bug. Sitting back on a Thalia for 4 turns isn't going to get them anywhere against Shardless. They gotta get going. They got to try to outmuscle them. They got to get that Voltron Stoneforge up. So that's what I consider to be a hybrid deck, is a deck that can pursue both game plans as it needs to. And I think Death Attacks is a good example of aggro control.
And there's a bunch of different hybrid decks that inhabit Legacy. Legacy is a gigantic monster with all sorts of interesting strategies. A couple of the more common ones I want to touch on, and if you follow our logic all the way through, you can understand why they fit into these categories. Other ones we have in aggro control would be Rug and Grixis Delver. Mid-range combo would be Food Chain and Alurin. Mid-range control would be decks like Shardless Bug and Four Color Loan. And one other combo control deck would be something like Imperial Painter.
One of the things mentioned in the analysis of Mike Flores, who's the beatdown, is that the decks that are often, you know, the format's strongest choices are the decks that are able to transition from the beatdown to the, you know, the deck with inevitability. And because of this, a lot of the decks in Legacy, because we have the card pool is so large and commits it, is that you will have the ability to, on, you know, most of the time, transition to to the control role if the matchup fits. Very rarely is a deck always going to be aggro or always going to be the control deck. That being said, I know Topher on Miracles is almost always the control deck. And Chance, you want to mention, you know, some of the matchups where you may not be a control deck, or maybe the matchups your counter spells don't really line up, like 12 posts and dredge?
Certainly. there are generally two situations where I find myself having to deviate from being the control deck. The first one is just the nature of the matchup. Against 12 posts, against Manless Dredge, decks were either my answers can't stop them, or they have inevitability over me. So against Cloud Post, Hard Guess Summer Cool beats anything I'm going to do. Against Manless Dredge, my counter spells are bad. Counterbalance doesn't really do anything against them. Jace can't hope to outgrind what they're doing. Terminus is probably the best answer I have against them, but they will rebuild. So what I have to do is I have to become a beatdown deck. I have to end the game because if I let it go on forever, they will beat me. So that is where I'm either racing to find my entreat, or if I'm fortunate in playing mainboard mentors, I get to also race and find mentor, which contextually is a much better answer. The other situation is game specific based on what my opponent has done. They've played a Planeswalker is what it generally means. Something that means that my inevitability is in question. And if I let the game continue on, I can't trust my late game to actually win me the game. So this might just mean the card advantage they'll get from a Planeswalker. It might mean the inevitable Liliana of the Veil ultimate, which will destroy my land base and make it impossible for me to get an entreat off. It might mean Chalice of the Void is on board. And as the game goes on, you know, one out of every four draws will be dead. So I can't trust my late game either. So like I said, it's game specific. And so that's why Monastery Mentor was such a big deal for Miracles, is because it gave Miracles the option to become the beatdown deck. In the context of Legacy itself, Mentor is certainly an answerable card. So you don't want to, as the control player, you've got to know when to just stick to your guns and don't waste your time trying to sneak a win. Just sit back on your control, versus when you've got to know that this, what they just did means I can't win the late game anymore. I've got to change gears.
Now, I know Miracles has a card like Monastery Mentor, which I would like to call like a turn the corner card. Can you guys think of some other examples of decks that have really strong turn the corner cards that can help switch a role really quickly?
Generally, if I'm thinking in terms of my own deck, I would say the biggest, I guess, would be Natural Order. They can just win out of nowhere. I can be on the board. We could be in a stalemate. I can be activating Death Threat Shaman twice a turn, trying to stay alive. Once that Natural Order hits, the game is generally over, whether it be because I've put so much resources into the Natural Order that if it gets countered, my shields are down and I'm probably going to lose, or Craterhoof comes to town.
Do you guys feel like these types of cards are generally risk-reward type of cards? Mentor is definitely an eminently answerable card, especially in other matchups. I know as a Miracles player, you don't generally want to run it out there on turn three and go to town unless you're in a compromised position like we just discussed. But Natural Order is definitely one of those risk-reward cards. If they have the Force of Will, that doesn't feel good. You've gotten two for one. But if it resolves, you're generally going to win the game.
Yeah, risk reward is a good example. I mean, you might win, let's just say, 55% of the games you jam a turn three Mentor, which, I mean, that's more than 50%, so why not do it? Except if you're not jamming that Mentor, maybe you win 60%. Just because it could be a good play doesn't mean it is a good play. What you're saying about cards to turn the corner, another one that comes to mind in terms of changing roles, you know, in a combo deck, any combo card is going to, if you were the combo deck, you've been the beatdown deck. So it's unlikely that your role is going to change because you're finally comboing off. But cards that could change the roles in decks that play multiple roles, or if you're playing against a deck that plays multiple roles, one that came to mind was Eye of Ugin in the context of Eldrazi. Eldrazi doesn't have any card advantage. It is always the beatdown deck. And what that means is the opponent is going to be playing reactive and trying to just not die and come over the top eventually. But Eye of Ugin does change that. It now means that they can't trust their inevitability. So they're going to have to close out the game, whether that means starting to turn their Goyf sideways, or if it means more aggressively trying to find their win con. Cards that force your opponent to change their game plan are always very good, because generally, if they're forced to change their game plan, it means they're changing to the lesser of the game plans.
The one, now when I think of you two, Brooks and Peter, I do think Life from the Loam is a big example of this. If you look at it,
I disagree strongly.
Okay.
Life from the Loam is great, but it's not a turn the corner card. I'd say crop rotation. Crop rotation could mean I can either combo now, I can get the piece I need, I can answer the threat on the board. Crop rotation can turn the game on its heels from a losing position to a winning. Life from the Loam is great, and it can recover some of the losses I've taken, but crop rotation can mean I can outwin.
All right.
That's the interesting thing about crop rotation, too, is that it is tempo positive at best and neutral at worst. Insofar as that, exactly what Peter said, you can go get the one card that answers a situation, or you can just go get a card to combo, or you just counter a wasteland.
Now, when I'm thinking of what I meant by, you know, Life from the Loam being a card that can change the corner, if I'm playing against lands, they are using Punishing Fire and Wasteland to, you know, kill my individual threats. You know, hitting a land here, hitting a land there. We hit a sort of top deck war. I get wastelanded a few times. I'm not dead when I'm wastelanded a few times. However, we get to the point where, guess what? Now I can pick the three most impactful cards that I've played earlier and reuse them. I'm going to start wastelanding you again. Usually, if I'm playing against lands, they don't see a Life from the Loam. I can come over the top of that. Although I do understand what you're saying about crop rotation. That is probably a much better example.
So as an Elves player, what do you fear more? Me being able to find a Life from the Loam, say you ate my first one, and me being able to rebuy back? Or would you fear me getting a crop rotation for a Tabernacle or potentially a Glacial Chasm, which could prevent you from being the beat down?
I would say I probably fear the Life from the Loam more. In terms of the game as a full progression of turns. At certain moments of the game, like my penultimate combo turn, I am going to fear that crop rotation for a Glacial Chasm. However, for the first turns it takes to get there, I fear Life from the Loam much more.
I think it's important to understand what we mean when we say a turn the corner card. I generally think of it... Any card, any combo card, any card deck is built around, it's obviously going to dramatically increase the power level of your deck in the context of the game. But when I think of a turn-the-corner card in the context of our discussion, I think more of a card that forces your opponent to change their game plan. I do not know the Elves versus Lands matchup. I'm going to assume that Elves is the beatdown deck. I cannot imagine... I cannot imagine that Elves can reliably shut down your combo. But I could imagine a scenario where the Elves player has to start making more defensive plays to keep a Deathrite Shaman active so that they can play a more controlling role to stop the advantage from Life from the Loam. At the same time, I can imagine a Lurin managing to get a Valras Stronghold on board. So now all of a sudden, their Delver opponent has to start thinking about how they're going to stop the advantage got from this Valras Stronghold. You know, Delver will have been the beat down up until the point that they can't be anymore. Generally, whenever your deck experiences an increase in in-game power, it forces a reaction from your opponent. Generally, they're reacting in a way that's contradictory to their main game plan.
These are types of cards that change how your opponents play. That doesn't mean that it's a card like Daze or Spell Pierce, which contorts plays, but a card that forces change by existing.
Yes. A card that would force your opponent to not play their primary strategy. That's why, you know, against Miracles, Planeswalkers are so good, because it forces the Miracles deck to momentarily become the beatdown deck. You know, anything that can force a Delver deck to become the control deck would be a turn the corner card. Anything that could force a combo deck to stop trying to combo is a turn the corner card.
Let me ask you guys a question. When you are sitting across from an unknown opponent and you go into the first turns of the game, what helps you decide whether you are the beatdown or you are the control? What factors do you look for? Is it correctly addressing the opponent's deck? Is it looking for how the opponent is posturing? Is it trying to read what you think they might have? Is it a combination of factors? Or is it just your own hand and where that leads you?
Miracles is always wants to be the control deck. So my hands are always going to be control in nature. So what I look for is see if I can figure out what my opponent is playing. Basically, I want to be able to recognize turn two at the latest what they're playing. Ideally, always turn one. And it's very possible to always know what they're playing by turn one. Because, you know, that tells me, all right, is my control plan going to work? Which aspect of my control plan do I have to pursue? How badly do I need to protect my win cons? You know, am I going to be able to win just through Snapcaster beatdown, or do I really have to get this and treat the Angels off at some point? Basically, knowing your matchups is what I consider to be the most important. I imagine that'd be a lot more significant playing a deck that more actively changes its game plans, like Delver, being able to recognize that that turn one Verdant for an Underground Sea means your opponent is on Bug, whereas a turn one Flooded Strand for Underground Sea means they could very well be on Combo. So knowing that, you know, do you want to play the turn one Deathrite Shaman that allows you to make a turn two him Wasteland play or something versus, I don't know, a turn one Delver to be a more aggressive play or something. Are you going to need to get the fastest clock possible, or can you afford to play the better game plan of developing your mana and threats?
I think a lot of this depends on whether the games are pre-board or post-board as well. I know I change my tune a lot of times going into game two or three. Also whether I'm on the player or the draw, about whether I'm going to be trying to kill them as fast as possible, or whether I'm going to be trying to grind the game out and go for that flawless victory that us lands folks are so known for.
Yeah, I know that generally from the elves perspective, while identifying what your opponent is playing is very important in the matchups, Deathrite's really the only card, at least especially in the main deck, that lets me change my roles. If I started off instead with a green Sun Zenith for a Dryad Arbor, at that point, I have to start going and hope I can get there. So because I'm most often the beat down, my games will start out where with me, basically, I want to set the tone of the game. Whereas with Miracles and often lands, you want to be more reactive, let your opponent show what they're trying to do. I don't. I want to natural order you to death on turn two, move three. But preferably turn two. Brooks, you mentioned that the games do change significantly post-sideboard. I think that's key with at least what I see on Elves. I got my sideboard right here with me. Two Mind Break Traps, some Decays, a Jit, Cabal Therapy, Thoughtseize, Pything Needle. Every single card that I just named in the sideboard of mine makes my deck more reactionary, which can often turn it off from the beatdown roll. If I know, if you're a combo deck, especially a graveyard combo deck, I will transition. You'll be the beatdown, and I will be reacting to what you're doing. However, since, you know, my main deck 60 cards, and I'm boarding in at most 7 or 8 cards in the matchup, Elves doesn't play the control route as well as, you know, a deck like Miracles, which sideboards to make it still be the control deck, but with a better suite of answers.
I feel like what you're getting at here is that different decks have different sideboard options available to them, which can change whether they're going to be the beatdown or the control in a certain matchup. For example, decks like Elves, if you look at the majority of the cards you just named, they are not creatures. So your normal game plan involves creatures, but when you play with the sideboard, you have inherently less creatures in your deck, which will make your overall strategy a little bit weaker because you're a creature deck. Whereas some decks will just board in cards that are generically powerful hate pieces, a la Leyline of the Void out of Eldrazi, or Null Rod, or some decks will have cards that more naturally flow into their playstyle, but are just more efficient, like Pyroblast or Surgical Extraction out of Miracles. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, is that when we're looking at what your role is and figuring out how you're going to act, especially post-sideboard, considering what you're bringing in and how it affects your deck, as well as what your opponent's bringing in and how it affects their deck. Are they going to change at all?
That is very true.
I mean, Topher, you say that Miracles almost always wants to be the control deck. Do you feel that your sideboard is fully optimized to embrace that plan?
Yes, definitely. You know, up until very recently, 15 out of 15 cards in my sideboard were reactionary in nature. I just went back to two mentors in my sideboard, which, frankly, most of the times they come in, is to give me the option to play beatdown when I can't trust my control game plan, or if I see an opportunity to essentially just steal games. But I think it's worth noting that people's sideboards are always going to be in opposition to their primary game plan, in the sense that the aggro beatdown elves sideboard is almost 100% reactionary. Frankly, most of the decks in Legacy are aggressive in nature, and most of their sideboards are reactionary. Now, it doesn't necessarily change their game plan of being an aggressive deck, but that is where their weaknesses are, and so that's what they need to cover in their sideboard. Miracles is one of the few decks in the format that is almost 100% reactionary, and therefore you find yourself wanting the sideboard option of being more aggressive. And that's where the mentors and the four Snapcaster come in.
Well, lands runs into a similar issue where it brings in trackers to dodge graveyard hate and to also be the beatdown. I know in our combo matchups are pretty poor, as we're not blue and we don't run a ton of disruption. We bring in Tracker as a means to race, and it's also very helpful in dodging Surgical Extraction, and drawing a bunch of cards is great too.
I mean, yeah, that's just another example of a deck that is generally reactionary needing to have the option to become the beatdown when it needs to be. One card can serve two roles, you know, like you said, Tracker's to dodge graveyard hate and to beat the beatdown. Mentor is to be the beatdown and come in where I think Entreat will be more easily answered, generally when I expect to be seeing more counter magic, like in the mirror.
There are basically two types of sideboard strategies. The strategies that, you know, the Tracker and the Mentor have to change the game plan, make yourself faster and dodge specific hate, you know, reactive cards to deal with whatever our opponents are doing, the matchup becomes slower and, again, more reactionary.
We'll be right back with our Super Secret Tech of the Week on Red Black Welder Reanimator. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. Every single week, it is our solemn duty to share with you our Super Secret Tech of the Week, in which we take a close look at a piece of technology. These are tournament tips, special cards, or even an entire deck. This week, we are talking about the pile of garbage that is my homebrew black-red reanimator hybrid Goblin Welder deck. I have not come up with a creative legacy name for this deck yet, so if you have any ideas, please shoot us an email. I am going to run this thing through a league today or tomorrow and see how well it goes. But without further ado, let's go on to the list. Our deck list is 4 Goblin Welder, 3 Hope of Gearipur, 1 Gristlebrand, 1 Sire of Insanity, 1 Mere Battlesphere, 1 Noxious Gearhulk, 1 Wormcoil Engine, 1 Sundering Titans, so that's all the fun offs there, 4 Lotus Petal, 2 Chrome Mox, 3 Sensei's Divining Top, 4 Faithless Looting, 4 Entomb, 4 Reanimate, 4 Exhume, 3 Thoughtseize, 2 Collective Brutality, 1 Duretti Scrap Savant. And our mana base is rounded out with 4 Badlands, 3 Bloodstained Mire, 3 Polluted Delta, 1 Cavern of Souls, 2 Vault of Whispers, 2 Great Furnace, 1 Swamp. Sideboard is yet to be decided upon, but it is greatly contested. So what do you guys think about this sweet, sweet, weldable deck of cards?
Oh, come on, man. I just want to see this in action. Hope of Gearipur lock? Come on, let's do this.
So if you didn't notice from the deck list that Brooks just mentioned, this deck is obviously there's a reanimator aspect to it where it uses this, you know, synergies between goblin welder and nice thick artifact creatures, cheated out much earlier than you could hard cast it. However, unlike Storm, which uses Xanted Swarm as purely protection, this list has a infinite combo that lets you silence your opponent on every single one of their turns.
Well, it's pseudo-silence. It's non-creature spells, so they can still beat you to death of creatures.
Yes.
Hope of Ghirapur, it really is a fascinating card. It has a lot of different dimensions to it. It can be used to shut down your opponent from playing... It can shut down your opponent from playing non-creature spells, a la Xanted Swarm for a turn. It can be welded in and out with Goblin Welder in matchups where you don't need that effect, like against elves. It can be recurred every turn against matchups like Storm, so they can never get a chance to go off, because you just continue to beat them for one every turn with the Hope of Ghirapur, sacrifice it, and then beat them with the Goblin Welder. Plus, it has the traditional Goblin Welder package. Mirror Battlesphere, Wormcoil Engine, Sundering Titan, a couple artifacts here and there. Go for value with the Sensei's Divining Top. You can tap that, weld it on the stack to bin the top, draw a raw card. Lots of fun interactions here. I am nervous because I think that it seems kind of janky, but you know.
Kind of janky, he said.
It seems very janky, but greatness, you know, greatness at any cost. Dark Confidant said it best. Even though I'm not playing any of those. And if the cost is 12 tickets, a couple hours of my pride being turned off, then you know what? Let's do it. Right.
And it's also my game because I'm absolutely going to watch this.
That is understandable.
We'll be right back with last week's trivia answer and this week's trivia question. Stay tuned. Lastly, we'd like to wrap up with an audience trivia question. Our question last week was, how would a silver-bordered foil copy of City of Traders come into existence? During Exodus, Wizards created test print cards for the foiling process we'd eventually know today, which was introduced in Urza's Legacy. These cards were created in many iterations and include such other cards as Plaguebearer, Oath of Lieges, and Survival of the Fittest, in addition to the aforementioned City of Traders. Cards are super rare and very expensive, so if you see one, it's very likely you've seen a very unique piece of Magic history. Unfortunately, if you are lucky enough to own one or more of these cards, sadly, you cannot play them in tournament play. Congratulations to Joseph B. for submitting the right answer. Joseph also asks if, since any of these are out in the wild or Wizards' property, they can reclaim them. While I'm not sure of this answer, I would imagine the various dealers who have them for sale and on display would have some conversations about their WPN status if that were the case. I know of a particular store in Tokyo, Big Magic, for anyone interested, who always brings out these beauties at every Grand Prix I've attended here in Japan, with no legal repercussions as far as I know. Anyway, we will be emailing you shortly to get your address so you can claim your draft set. Now, on to this week's question. What Alliance's card was nicknamed Good Buddy during playtesting? If you email us the correct answer, we have a special prize for you this week, which Adam will be emailing you. A playset of Golgari Grave Trolls due to his saltiness after the ban. Not only they're not just regular Grave Trolls, they are Japanese Golgari Grave Trolls.
Yes, this could make the dredger in your life very happy.
I'm always on the lookout for the dredgers in my life.
Yeah, you know those people that want to break the fundamental rules of magic? Well, they
There's
can now
one
do
of
it.
Them in the room.
They take the fun out of fun, the mental.
Yeah, not only can they do it, they can do it, and you can't even read what they're doing. So show them you love them. Get them these Grave Trolls. All you need to know is one easy trivia question. And by easy, I mean I had no idea.
Well, either way, if you know the correct answer, go ahead and shoot us a line at sstmtgcast@gmail.com. That's sstmtgcast@gmail.com. Of all the correct answers submitted, I will randomly select a winner in a week's time. You can find the show on Twitter at SuperSecretMTG. You can also find me on MTGO at OneWithNothing, Adam on MTGO at ABombDiggity, Topher on MTGO at MZFrost, or just look at the top of the Legacy League leaderboards, and Peter on MTGO at Brains478. Any questions, comments, concerns, tips, tricks, or the trivia answer for today's cast can be emailed to the same email address I mentioned before. That's sstmtgcast@gmail.com. On behalf of myself, Adam, Topher, and Peter, thank you very much for listening. We will catch you next week.